chapter 43. For any of the last part of this course to make sense to you, you have to understand that Shakespeare blew the seams off the worlds of art, philosophy, and communication. Lashley lit his pipe, took his coffee, moved to the window. I've got a theory that I want you to listen to. I'm only going to try it for today, and I promise never to mention it again if absolutely no one knows what I'm talking about. Lashley smiled, and there was a gentle laugh, a long murmur in the class. He listened to it like it was a body of water. He studied it and tried to perceive areas where the light of understanding that his father had taught him to look for shone. Then he spoke softly. In King Lear, Shakespeare goes out the bottom of the world of tragedy. He has a vision of existence more frighteningly real than the mind could tolerate. At this point in his life and writing, he undergoes a dramatic change. He begins to see the world as a magical place. He sees language floating off into a more pure form of communication, music. He envisions a place in creation where one can live once again beyond the realm of tragedy. Lashley made his now familiar journey back to the desk, where he shuffled more papers, picked up his second container of coffee. He listened to the class. Again, he looked for the light. Shakespeare writes four plays after King Lear. King Lear was the last installment in a series of tragedies, which are generally considered the greatest plays in the English language. But each of these last plays is a radically different attempt to understand the nature of life itself. All of Bill Shakespeare's work is highly treasured, but in these first three plays of this new series, it seems to me that he is unclear about what he is trying to say. He's a rich man now, with a large reputation, so we know that he has no longer any writing for money need, but because he believes in the theater, the same way a scientist believes in his laboratory, he has stretched the dimensions of his lab well beyond what was thought to be possible. I can imagine him standing in the wings, looking out at his audience. He's watching a mysterious woman about 40 years old. He sees her face at the conclusion of Cymbeline and knows that she is confused. He goes off and writes Pericles and realizes that for all intents and purposes, the second play is even murkier for her. She begins to have some flashes of understanding during the Winter's Tale, but still doesn't get it until he writes The Tempest. Lashley stopped for a disclaimer. Now I know that someone is going to read that he wrote another play, and perhaps portions of still another, and I want to tell you that those don't matter. What matters is whether or not this woman is finally able to understand. Shakespeare delivers his farewell to the stage at the end of this play. It is my belief that he is talking directly to this woman. And it is in that spirit that I want you to read this last piece of literature for this semester. As soon as he went home, Ron opened the book and began to read. At about 9 p.m., he started for the second time. By 2 a.m., he finished his recording journal entry and went to sleep. He cut all of his classes again on Thursday. The preparations for the trip to Washington seemed endless and not without impediments. Which people was he actually taking with him? What would be their role once they arrived? Were there certain events that must be covered? The school's conservative daily ran two large articles which opposed student participation and funding because it would give the college a bad name and attract outsiders who would do the school no good. There was a letter from the president of the college addressed directly to him that stated any students arrested because of involvement in illegal activities would be candidates for proper disciplinary action, which remained undefined. Chris advised Ron that everybody was covering their bases and that there was nothing to be upset about. When he ran into Rebecca, she told him that she wanted to be his friend. Ron answered that he had no time for the type of friendship she was talking about. After reading the play again on Thursday night, Ron felt extremely confident about the next day's class. He drove to school early and drank 2 containers of coffee. In the newspaper room, while he was waiting, Ron was nervous as he waited for Lashley to arrive. The long-haired blonde kid asked if anybody read the assignment and received a series of "Who had time to read?" answers. Lashley arrived with an entourage. First Irene, followed by the red-haired girl, followed by the clicking of Lashley's heels in the hall, which always seemed to be moving at a galloping speed. Ron placed 2 questions on the sideboard. Why isn't Prospero guilty of the same kind of action the U.S. is taking in Vietnam? And what is magic? Lashley placed his material in neat piles and moved over to the windowsill with his coffee. Ron liked the way he seemed to drink the questions in along with the coffee and then use his pipe for the pondering process. Ron saw Lashley read his first question. "Whose question is that about Vietnam?" "Mine," said Ron. Lashley took a long swallow of coffee and stared back at the board. "You didn't understand the play at all, did you?" There was a smattering of laughter and a smirk from the blonde-haired kid that Ron didn't notice. Ron was busy blushing. "No, I guess I didn't see the play the way you wanted me to at all." "It has very little to do with anything I wanted, except, of course, you reading the play," said Lashley. Shrugging at the blonde-haired kid who shrugged back at him, Lashley looked back at the board, and then back at Ron. "Your second question is genuine, and therefore better. At least I think it's genuine," said Lashley, raising an eyebrow at Ron. "Now, the real question is, what is Shakespeare after here?" Ron raised his hand. "Isn't that just your question?" "That's not the idea. Whose question it is, but the more beautiful and greater questions of the play." Ron felt insulted. "Where do you figure the question's answers are?" Lashley moved quickly. "Let's get rid of your first thing early so that we don't have to talk about it anymore. Prospero is set adrift with his daughter by the state to be victimized or learn to survive in nature. The United States was driven to Vietnam by different motivations. But magic is the stuff of dreams and what they are composed of." The beautiful red-haired girl laughed and said, "A bit of cheese or an undigested piece of beef." The line seemed somehow familiar, but Ron couldn't quite place it. "In keeping with the season," said Lashley, smiling at her. "Yes, I'm sure there's some truth there, but that's not the kind of answer Ron is looking for, is it?" Ron was still fuming about why Lashley had avoided his question about the war. "I still don't understand why my first question isn't important." Lashley sighed, but Ron had the ball and he was going to run with it. "The island belongs to Caliban, and Prospero conquers him and makes him a slave." "Caliban tried to rape his daughter," said Lashley. "There's no excuse for slavery anywhere," accused Ron. He felt Lashley's drawl hung out like a burning KKK cross in front of the class. "What you mean to say is that Prospero conquers Caliban in order to enslave him. Caliban makes himself a slave." "That sounds an awful lot like the excuses that people use to justify slavery in this country." Lashley seemed to visibly straighten. "I know that most of the reasons and excuses for slavery are nonsense. They've been given to me all my life. What I'm trying to tell you is that this isn't a place to ask those questions. You have to ask those questions everywhere, said Ron in a loud, victorious voice. I suppose that you do. But if you don't know where or when to find the best answers, but what I'm trying to talk about goes beyond the two-dimensional world of politics. Ron didn't know what he meant by two-dimensional, so he decided he better keep his mouth shut. Later, Lashley ended the class by saying he was going to spend Monday on the same play, and that he was going to have some things to say about the final exam. On Friday, Hank woke up just before dawn and the feeling that he had run out his string of options. He thought about pool, the grace of the way a good pool player separated his shots from the pack, lined things up just right, and brought his skill to perfection. A good pool game was the applied synthesis of mathematical principles coupled with fate and good fortune. It was exquisite. He wanted to go through life with the same feeling he experienced during a long run at the table. He would be fully alive and paying attention. Only he would decide where and when he should move. It would be he that held the timing of the rest of the world for as long as he could keep making shots. Hank closed his eyes. The problem was that things had become so complicated that every step he took began to look like a shot, and trouble was that you couldn't be sure of making them all. The day before, he had told Joe Lee he was going to work, and instead he had driven to his mother's house. She was expecting him and had laid out a coffee mug and a napkin next to his uncollected mail. He was surprised by her insight, but didn't mention it to her. The gist of things was he can go back to work on Friday. But after that, the job was gone. Your father is very upset. Hank started to say that he didn't care, but she cut him off. He feels hurt and let down. Does he? Said Hank. It's good to know that he feels things. Hank told his mother he would go back to work, but it was like she didn't hear him. If things don't work out, you've always got a home here. Hank figured that he had about an hour to decide if he should go back to work there. He could really take any shot he wanted, as long as he could gain enough position to get himself through the table. Hank, you're going to be late for work, said Joe Lee, shaking him. He must have fallen back asleep. When he came to his senses, she saw that she made him breakfast and laid out his work clothes. Hank put them on quietly. He was a prisoner who lived behind his own thoughts because that was the only place that was his own. Drinking his coffee and eating his buttered roll, he tried to figure out what he was going to do with the day. The phone's ring caused his heart to beat faster. He was squirming by the time Joe Lee answered it. He couldn't hear what she was saying, but she returned to the room quickly and announced that his father wanted to talk to him. Hank hadn't expected the old man to call, and his first thought was that he didn't want to talk with him, but he found himself moving to the telephone. Hello, he said, trying to sound bland and noncommittal. Hank, I'm getting ready to leave for work. I want to know if you're going to be there or not. Probably not, said Hank. Hank, has your mother explained to you that I can't carry you beyond this week? I know that. And you're telling me that you're not coming in? I don't think so. You don't want to give it one more try? It's not a good idea. Okay, Hanky. Your mother wants to talk to you. Hank felt himself sweating. Hank? Yes. Will you be down to see us soon? I suppose so. I'll be expecting you sometime next week, then. They said goodbye. Hank went back into the kitchen. What did your father want? Joe Lee was expecting to hear something about the business that required the old man's checking with him. He called to tell me not to come into work. Her face became tight and hard. Hank saw the reaction and made him angry. Why not? She said darkly. Because I'm fired. Your father called up and fired you? Sort of. What happened, Hank? He didn't care anymore. He felt the pressure was too heavy, and he didn't care what it said about him or anything else. I'm fired because I didn't want to go back to work anymore. What are you telling me? Are you telling me that your father up and fired you, or that you didn't want to work? What difference does it make? I don't have a job anymore. It makes a big difference to me, Hank. I want to know why your father called and what happened. Hank's mind was running like a spinning carousel. Why do you want to know? So you can belittle me and badger me about it? So you can tell me how Tony would have handled it and laugh because I'm a Martian? I'm past the stage of laughing. She sat down and didn't say anything. She looked into her coffee and thought about where she could be living when this was all over. She wondered if she could afford to stay in this apartment. Hank had been right about one thing. There was always Tony. She looked up and saw Hank smirking at her. It washed away her sadness with a burst of anger that seemed to come up from around her everywhere. You're going to be a pathetic little worm, aren't you, Hank? It's certainly a long way from being a big snake, isn't it? Hank's sarcasm gnawed away a little at what was keeping her from battering him with something. She wanted to take a light bulb and crush it into his face. I hate the way you make me feel. So do I. But at least it's good that we feel something. Jolie couldn't hold it back anymore. You worthless prick, she screamed, reaching up for two handfuls of Hank's tangled, reddish, blonde hair. She shook his head back and forth, trying to tear it out of his head. She was screaming and crying at the same time. At first, Hank thought he was going to pass out from the pain, but if he closed his eyes and gritted his teeth as hard as he could, it might stop. Jolie pushed him away, picked up another coffee cup, and hurled it into the sink. It shattered. She screamed again, picked up his coffee cup, and threw it through the window, which also shattered. She reached for the chair, and Hank tried to stop her. He wasn't quick enough. She caught him in the neck and chest with the back of the chair and drove him into the refrigerator. You'd be better off if I killed you, Hank. There was only a trace of tears on her face now. I should take a knife and stab you or bash your head in with a frying pan while I've got you like this. Hank was gasping for air. She pushed the chair harder against his neck. You're even too sad to kill. She released the chair. Hank grabbed it and threw it across the room. She cried with wrenching sobs that shook her belly. I loved you, and you made a fool out of me. Hank watched her with his eyes frozen on her words. The joke is that you're too big a fool to blame. I guess I'd better leave, said Hank. I knew that you'd say that. She was still crying, but softly now. Hank went into the bedroom, changed from his work clothes. A voice that said, "How could she do this to me?" pounded in his head.